ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm Eric Anderson, and on today's show, we're joined by Dr. Robert Stadler to talk about the origin of life and a wonderful new installment in the Long Story Short video series. Stadler received a degree in biomedical engineering from Case Western Reserve University, a master's in electrical engineering from MIT, and a PhD in medical engineering from the Harvard-MIT Division of Health Sciences and Technology. He's worked in the medical device industry for more than 20 years, has over 140 patents, and is co-author of the recent book, The Stairway to Life, An Origin of Life Reality Check. Great to have you back on the show, Rob.
Hello, Eric. Thanks for hosting. It's always a pleasure to discuss the origin of life.
Yeah, definitely one of my favorite topics, and I know yours as well, so I'm looking forward to it. So in addition to the book that came out last year, you've been active in debates and discussions about origins, and you recently spearheaded an animated YouTube video project about the origin of life. What led you to take an interest in this, and what was your goal with this project?
The video, yeah, it's called The Basic Building Blocks and the Origin of Life, and that's on the Discovery Institute's YouTube channel. And I need to emphasize it was a team effort, so we had five PhDs to provide the scientific content, and then we had two animator producers that did the real work. But what motivated me, I think back to a particular spark that happened about 5 years ago when I visited a friend I hadn't seen in a while. And this was a very well-read friend who had a master's from Harvard. Mm-hmm. And somehow we got on the topic of origin of life. And he told me that through his readings and you know, the media, the news, that he was very convinced that scientists in a laboratory were able to take basic chemicals and produce life in the lab, basically, you know, simple bacteria or something like that. And to my surprise, I couldn't convince him otherwise. Hmm. And then more recently, some people might be familiar with Jim Tor's series of videos on the origin of life, where he points to a survey that was conducted by Professor John Narcum from Arkansas Tech. And he had surveyed 715 people and asked them, true or false, scientists researching the origin of life have created simple life forms, such as bacteria, from scratch. And again, it totally surprised me to find out that 72.7%, so that's basically 3 out of 4 people, said that it was true.
Yeah, I remember listening to Tour's video series, and that really jumped out at me as well. I was like, what? That's pretty astonishing.
So, I mean, we all know that science confuses the public, and public perception of scientific results is somehow not always accurate. But to get 3 out of 4 people to believe something that's very dramatically false and to believe that it's true, that there's got to be something going on here that's confusing people that badly. And yeah, I'm quite motivated to try to correct it.
Awesome. Great. Yeah, no, I like I mentioned, that was just a really astounding result that that survey came out with. So glad that both you and Jim Tour and others are trying to correct the perception that exists out there in the public. So it as part of that, you recently wrote a series of posts at Evolution News. One of them you called Researchers Overlook Toxic Products in Origin of Life Experiments. What do you mean by toxic products, and how is this relevant to abiogenesis?
When we think of the word toxic, we often think of it in a biological sense, you know, that mm-hmm. it can kill life. But here we're talking about before life began. And so we're actually talking about toxic in the chemical sense, something that interferes with a chemical reaction or gets in the way of a desired product. That's toxic in the chemical sense.
Okay.
So origin of life researchers, you know, most famously you have Miller-Urey, but a lot of others since then, they have an experiment with the goal of producing some kind of a molecule that's related to life, and to do it under prebiotic conditions. And they design and perform the experiment, and they stop the reaction when they want to. And then they use their high-tech equipment searching through the products, trying to find that molecule that they deeply desire. And when they find it, doesn't matter how much of it they found it. And they write a paper mm-hmm. and they summarize their success, and then they just move on. And they don't tend to mention what else is left in the beaker.
Yeah.
And some of that may be because it's very difficult to characterize fully all the organic stuff that's in there. It's just too difficult. But it's quite misleading to just push it aside. If the investigator ignores the other products when they write up the results, then the reader or the public is also probably just going to ignore what's left in the beaker. And they tend to assume that that desired molecule that they want is now free to go on and progress toward life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not at all the reality. You know, there's the other stuff that's left is quite important. Just as a practical example, in our video, we cite a paper from 2007 where they worked on producing purines, which are components of DNA and RNA in a prebiotic situation. And they succeeded in producing alanine, which is part of DNA and RNA, but it was only 0.011% of what they produced. And so the other 99.99% was not what they wanted, and it can't be ignored because it gets in the way. Not only does it dilute the desired product, but it can actually cross-react or sequester or degrade that desired product. And that's what I mean by toxic in a chemical sense. So you just can't ignore the other stuff.
Yeah. The cross-reactions become a huge problem as you're trying to move forward to the next steps. And there's also some results from a computer simulation called Alchemy. It's kind of a clever spelling, A-L-L-C-H-E-M-Y, referring to all chemistry, but also harking back to alchemy. So kind of a fun spelling there. But the simulation that these researchers put together seeks to create, they say, a tree of life from basic chemicals. So you take things like ammonia, water, nitrogen, methane, so on. Choose your basic chemicals, and then the program builds, as I understand it, kind of a chemical tree, so to speak, of the possible chemical products that could result from the numerous reactions. You talked about one particular result of the Alchemy simulation. Tell us what that result was and how it compares with real-world experiments.
Yeah, so if you read this fine print in that paper that you mentioned, I find it very interesting, but they say that after just 7 rounds of chemical reactions in this simulation, they're able to analyze all the products. You know, I said it's too hard to analyze very complicated organic mess, but because it's a computer simulation, they know all the products. And they turned out after 7 rounds, they had produced more than 36,000 different molecular structures that actually are not related to life. They're not found in life. And they only produced 82 different molecular structures that are found in life.
Pause there just a second, Rob, because 36,000 is a huge number. How did they get to that after just 7 rounds? We've got some kind of, they're starting with multiple initial chemicals, and what's going on there to get so many different products?
Well, it's combinatorial. You know, if you start with these 6 compounds and they're allowed to cross-react and you do it 7 times, you have exponential growth of what comes out of it. And it's a random process that's going to fill out the chemical space in quotation marks of all the possibilities. And any random process is just going to naturally fill out that space. But it turns out that biology is extremely selective about its molecules, and they take up a very small part of all the chemical space. And that's the real problem here, is 99.8% of the molecules they produced are undesired. And you never hear about that. People don't talk about it. They just push that stuff aside because they're focusing on the molecules they do want.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, just to give it a little more practical result, because that was a computer simulation, but a lot of people are familiar with the Murchison meteorite, which contains organic compounds from outer space. And again, the focus of manuscripts on that have been to say, hey, we found amino acids in this meteorite from outer space. Therefore, natural processes can produce amino acids. Well, we're not debating that natural processes can produce amino acids. We're talking about all the other junk. I found one paper that said that, you know, the Murchison meteorite contained tens of thousands of different molecular compositions and likely millions of diverse structures. And that suggests that the extraterrestrial chemodiversity is high compared to terrestrial relevant biological and biochemical driven chemical space. Again, saying that you've got all this stuff that is not of interest, and biology is very selective with just a few molecules of interest, and you can't ignore the other stuff.
Right. Yeah. And it's not just that it's not of interest. It's that it gets in the way when you're trying to go to the next step, right? It interferes. You have molecules.
Exactly.
That's why
we call it toxic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we're not even mentioning here, by the way, the question of homochirality, which is a big issue, but we're ignoring that, you know, to be nice right. to the origin of life story here for a minute. We're just talking about all the other chemicals that are available.
Yes, we're pushing a lot of other challenges aside. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Rob, but let me be the devil's advocate for a minute. If we produce at least something useful, okay, we got 0.1% or something, can't we use that to move forward with abiogenesis? I mean, isn't it great that, yeah, there's a lot of junk, but we did get a few things that we wanted.
Yeah, again, we're not trying to contest that they were able to produce that small amount of stuff. But unless you can remove all those interfering non-biological molecules and then you concentrate what remains and you ignore any natural degradation, you can't really go forward. We haven't talked about degradation, but for an example, you take ribose, which is the sugar that's the backbone of RNA. That actually has like a half-life of 73 minutes at 100 degrees Celsius and neutral pH. And so origin of life researchers talk about millions of years for these chemicals to do their thing and develop and become more complicated. But, you know, ribose has this half-life that can be 73 minutes. So that's going to be quite a challenge to move forward.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I thought was brought out well in the video that you guys produced was the fact that time is not helpful here. And I know Jim Tour has talked about that as well. Often time is seen as the great savior of the abiogenesis story. And you'll hear people say, well, we've got millions of years or billions of years. But in fact, time is the enemy when you're dealing with biomolecules that have a particular time frame within which they can exist. And if they die off, well, guess what? You get to start over.
And it's a little too convenient to ignore the natural degradation that occurs.
Exactly. That's a great point. So that point actually ties in nicely also with your third post on Evolution News that you titled Purifying Bad Results, How Origin of Life Researchers Cheat Via Relay Synthesis. Tell us a little more about this idea of relay synthesis and the problem you're focusing on there.
Sure. So these manuscripts, you know, you take like what Miller Urey accomplished, and they produce some amino acids with this other junk. You know, there's all this other stuff there. You never hear of the next step where a researcher will ask Miller Urey for some of the beaker of what they produced, and then I'll take it from here to take on the next step.
Right.
And that's because they're basically admitting they know that what was produced in the previous experiment really can't go forward because of all these other problems. Mm-hmm. And so in the next step, they'll go buy themselves a clean beaker and they'll buy pure amino acids from some laboratory supply shop. They might even get the homochiral version, and maybe even those products can only be produced by biological processes.
Right. Yeah. Often the case, right? Yeah.
And they'll start over. That's why it's called relay. It's kind of like one runner handing off the baton to the next runner, and they'll try to do the next step. And if they're able to, you know, polymerize those amino acids to make a polypeptide or something, they'll write the paper and claim success. But the injection of reality here is kind of missing of how do you go from what Miller Urey produced and then take it to the next step without cheating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And so what is the relevance of this concentration and purity in moving chemical reactions forward to the next step? You mentioned that researchers might go buy the pure form of the chemical before they move on to the next step.
Yeah, purity of the reactants in very high concentration, that's naturally going to drive the reaction toward product. And some people might be familiar with your high school chemistry lesson on Le Chatelier's principle. Any reaction that has an equilibrium state is going to be driven toward product if you have more and more concentrated reagents in the beginning. I mean, I kind of get it as proof of concept. It's okay to start with pure ingredients to demonstrate that proof of concept. But after that, having done that, you need to go back and inject some reality, you know, some natural, less concentrated and have some impurities in there and make it seem more like reality.
Yeah.
In my own research on heart failure, I'm trying to make heart beat stronger and, fix heart failure. But so I could take like a petri dish with some myocardial cells in it and apply some kind of treatment and show that the cells are beating more forcefully, and then write a paper and claim success. Hey, I've cured heart failure. We no longer have any problem. But of course, that would be very misleading because I haven't reduced that to practical use. I haven't tried it on even animals intact or humans to show that it actually does work. And that's kind of what's happening, I think, with this origin of life. They do the pristine experiment with highly concentrated reagents, and they get the result they want, and they just quit there and move on and claim success.
Wouldn't you say, though, that the word cheating is maybe a little harsh? Don't researchers have to start somewhere? Maybe we should just, you know, kind of let them do their thing and stay out of the way and stop criticizing here.
Yeah, it is a little harsh of a term. It's a strong term, but you know, in medicine, in the field I work in, journals really expect any manuscript you publish to openly disclose the limitations of the work that you did.
Right.
So for example, if I study a new drug and I'm trying to treat like thyroid cancer, when I write up the results, the limitations should make it very clear that this is only applied to thyroid cancer, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't apply to prostate cancer or lung cancer or something else. Otherwise, I'd be cheating if people overused that drug and started to apply it to, you know, the different scenarios and different kind of cancers. And when you see, you know, going back to that survey result where 3 out of 4 people said that they believe that simple life has been created in a lab, that's massively wrong.
Yeah.
And I believe, unfortunately, that kind of corruption of public understanding, it has come through, it's developed over the years through a sort of an indoctrination, a bunch of cheating that's been going on in manuscripts and in the media and how they describe what's been going on with Origin of Life. It's misleading.
Yeah, definitely misleading. And there's a failure in this area, I think, of, you know, basic requirement that you have to sit down and look at the problem that you're trying to address rather than just taking, like you say, one little tiny piece in a purified form and maybe in some cases in a way that's not even consistent with early life conditions and say, aha, you know, we found X and so we're going to run off and write a paper about it.
And being very open in writing up your limitations. I hardly ever see that in Origin of Life manuscripts. They just don't tend to talk about it.
Well, and there's also very little in terms of what if you're wrong, right? I mean, at least, hey, there's lots of problems in the pharmaceutical industry. I don't want to get into that as well. But certainly, at least there's still some accountability in the sense that, hey, if I do something that doesn't work in the real world, I'm going to be called on the carpet about it. Whereas in abiogenesis research, so often there's just no accountability for, you know, wild ideas, speculations, theories that are thrown out there because, you know, nobody, you know, they're not building a product. They're not putting something out there that's going to actually harm people. And so they just can speculate with impunity.
Right. And we're very much more heavily required accuracy when it comes to life and death situations like medicines. We're very focused on getting that right. Whereas with Origin of Life, there isn't that accountability, as you mentioned.
Yeah. So you wrote that getting these building blocks is only the, and I should just emphasize here for our listeners, when we're talking about building blocks, we're not even talking about RNA and DNA nucleotides. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, is that there is still no plausible prebiotic path to get even a single nucleotide. We're talking about even smaller building blocks before that.
Well, I believe John Sutherland has shown that he can get to nucleotides under the right conditions, but it's debatable how prebiotic that is. But yes, we are talking about just the building blocks like amino acids, nucleobases, lipids, sugars. Yep.
Yeah. So if we assume we've got some of these building blocks, doesn't that get us pretty far toward abiogenesis, some would argue?
Yeah. In the book I wrote, we kind of list out a bunch of requirements to get toward life. And I would say that getting to these basic building blocks is not even 1% of the required steps to get toward life. As we've mentioned, not only producing the building blocks, but you need to get rid of all those undesired or toxic molecules. You need to concentrate what's left. You need to progress toward life further than by getting homochirality and by getting precise linkage of these monomer molecules into polymers like proteins and RNA and DNA, and you have to get information somehow into the RNA and DNA. That's a tricky one. You have to have self-replication of the molecules, which has never been demonstrated in any form. And then you have to have regulation of these molecules. You have to be able to harness energy and use that energy to have both low entropy and very high enthalpy, which is a very unnatural state. And you have to have membranes that are actively and selectively pushing molecules in and out, you know, to maintain homeostasis. And you have to have repair mechanisms for the I could go on and on. So this is just the beginning and the first step toward life.
Yeah, go read the book, right?
Yeah,
no, that's great. That's really important. And so back to this survey that we kind of started our conversation with, just to wrap up here and close the loop. If people think that researchers in the lab have created something like a bacterium, we're not even on the path, really. I mean, at best, we've got a few of these small building blocks, potentially under semi-appropriate conditions with this relay synthesis and everything else that's going on that's problematic. And that's really kind of where we're stuck at this point.
And unfortunately, the unbridled optimism of the researchers and then the media that pick up these stories and amplify them, I'm afraid they have to take some responsibility for this dramatic public misunderstanding. And I would like to have them help correct the problem. And it's not just because people are easily duped or they don't understand science. I mean, you can't get 3 out of 4 people to believe something dramatically false unless you work at it for a while.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And hopefully, you know, this podcast and your video series and your book and other things that are happening, you know, Jim Tuer's efforts and Dr. Brian Miller and others, you know, hopefully we're getting the message out a little bit and helping to start correct some of these misunderstandings. So, well, thanks so much, Rob, for being with us today. Again, congratulations on this great video. I definitely encourage listeners to check it out. It's at the Discovery Science channel on YouTube. It's also an easy and non-intimidating way to share this important message with a friend. So feel free to watch that great video. It's about 10 minutes long. Share a link with a friend. And really appreciate you being with us here today, Rob.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. To learn more about the origin of life, visit us at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. And as always, consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.